Welcome to Rubber Bands, an Avenues Recovery podcast. Conversations about the push and pull of addiction and recovery. And now, here's your host, Shlomo Hoffman.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 6 of Rubber Bands, conversations about the push and pull of addiction and recovery. We continue to shed light on the world of addiction treatment by talking to the people who make up its heart and soul, those who have gone through it and those that have helped them get through it, sharing their experiences and insight on how people can find their way back from the darkest places and light up the world for themselves and for those that love them. We're grateful today for a special guest, Brian Cuban, Texas-based, noted author, blessed with an ability to shine a light on the humanity of those valiantly fighting addiction. His book, The Addicted Lawyer, focused on the struggle specific to those in the legal profession and the unique perspective of professionals battling addiction. Hi, Brian. How you doing? Thanks for coming on.
Hey, good. Good. Thanks for having me on.
Really appreciate it. You know, we look around for all different elements of, you know, addiction and what it causes and the stories. And, you know, what you tackled here in your book, in The Addicted Lawyer, was a unique perspective on the professional battle. At a more general level, you know, you open the book, the first story, I want you to share that story with us. The first story that you start the book with, and it sort of like illustrates the cycle, you know, the shame and I could get through this. And, you know, the story of you waiting to go to Dallas Mavericks game and bartering your tickets. You want to share that story with us?
Yeah. I was going to have to ask you to remind me what the first story is. It's been a while since I read my own book. It was the summer of, the summer of 2006, and the Mavs were going to the NBA championship for the first time. And my brother Mark owns the team. So as you might imagine, I've had access to some pretty good seats. Right. And so I also had the opportunity to get a couple tickets for friends. So I called him up, said, sure, Brian, come on over, get the tickets. I got the two really nice lower bowl tickets. And you're probably thinking, did I give them to my friends? No, I didn't. You're probably one thinking I sold them on eBay for some astronomical amount, thinking like a lawyer, right? I didn't do that either.
I don't know how Mark would have handled that if you were turning around his tickets, no?
No, yeah, that way, yeah, if it got out, that wouldn't have been good. And I didn't do that either because that would be certainly disrespectful to Mark and the team and all that. But what wasn't disrespectful in my mind was trading him to my drug dealer for $1,000 in cocaine, right? How the mind works in addiction. So my dealer shows up at my house. I was high class. He delivered. And I give him the tickets. He hands me this giant Ziploc baggie of blow. I go running up to my home office. I dump it all out on this long wooden desk like I have here in front of me. Just giant cocaine kingdom. And I wanted to go like I'm Scarface and rub my nose in it. And of course I had to do some. So I bought it, pull out a dollar bill, roll it up. Isn't it funny about cocaine users, right? Especially in pandemic times, we'll wash our hands, antiseptic, lather them up with antiseptic, wash them in the bathroom, but we'll shove a straw. We'll shove a dollar bill up our nose. That's been God knows where, used by God knows who, without any problem whatsoever.
No germophobia in cocaine.
Yes, we are weird, though, an ironic bunch. But cocaine had long stopped giving me the feeling of love and acceptance, self-love and acceptance that I achieved and felt when I did it in a bathroom in Dallas, Texas for the very first time in the summer of 1987, and became instantly enamored with that feeling because I was someone who had grown up with a lot of trauma and literally hated myself for much of my life, and up to that point, all of my life. So to love myself, albeit artificially, for the first time was an overpowering feeling. And it was a feeling that I had to have again and again. But sitting in my home office all these years later, it was just pain and shame and chasing a high that was never going to come again, chasing the dragon, right?
Right.
And so there was also the paranoia. Do I hear the cops outside? Woo-woo-woo, you know, the curtains are closed. I've been in dealers' houses and users' houses where they have cardboard over the windows and things like that because we're all paranoid. I'm peeking out there, and I take the cocaine. I put it back in the Ziploc baggie. I hide it, and I drive to a Home Depot where I buy electrical faceplate outlets, a drill, and a saw. I drive back to my house, and I go upstairs to the drywall in the closets in the different bedrooms with the drill and the saw bzz, 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 and cut out these rectangular fake electrical outlets. I take the cocaine, I put it in smaller Ziploc baggies, and I shove it in behind the drywall and all these fake electrical outlets.
So at that point, you had decided not to use that night? Is that what was going on? And you were just putting it away?
I had a bad high, and I didn't want to use anymore. And I had left some out, but, and I hide it all because I'm paranoid.
Right.
And the cops are out there, and they're not. And so I drill the electrical faceplate outlets, the screws in, bzz, 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 thinking I'm the smartest lawyer ever. Like the DEA, the cops, and the drug dogs have never thought of that one before. I do a little more, line out what I left on the desk, and again, just that terrible high. And it was never about, maybe you have a problem, Brian. It was about, maybe I need to change dealers. Maybe I need to switch out the Grey Goose for the Jack Daniels to find that better equilibrium that we seek. And then came the paranoia again. I go back to the electrical outlets with the drill, bzz, 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 and I take the cocaine back out and put it back in the original Ziploc baggie and go to the bathroom and go to the master bathroom and flush it down the toilet. Now it's $900 worth of cocaine. The next morning, I wake up.
Did you make it to the game?
No, didn't make it to the game. I wake up and I think to myself, Did I really flush the balance of that cocaine down the toilet? There's another game tonight. Who does that? What kind of idiot flushes $900 worth of cocaine down the toilet? I call my drug dealer back up. I call Mark, get two more tickets for the game that night. I call the dealer. He shows up at my house. He said, dude, you did all that last night? I didn't want to tell it. I would tell him I flushed it down the toilet like a moron. I said, yes, I did it all. Give me more. Okay, here you go. Back up to my home office, dump it out on the desk again, rinse, wash, repeat, snort some more, again, just paranoia and just the bad highs. I was, the good highs were gone. And I go back to the electrical outlets, bzz, 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 hide it again, hide it all again, get more paranoid, take it back out, maybe 2 hours later, go back to that same bathroom, drop to my knees like I'd done so many times before, waiting, hoping, praying for someone or something to take away the pain of my addiction as I retched and flushed it again. They say when Dallas flushes, it runs downhill to Houston. So some people in Houston may have had a little extra hip hop in their step.
How generous of you.
Yeah. The quote unquote insanity of addiction. Doing something the same way, doing something over and over the same way and expecting a different result. But we know it's not quote unquote insane, right? It's a biological brain-based process that affects so many of us. And I was no different.
And you know, that story resonated with me because, you know, while you're so addicted and you need that cocaine high, you also know that it's terrible for you and you're flushing it down the toilet because you know, like, this is not the way. And then you do it all again. So until you figure out a way how to exit, you know, how to really make a change.
I can't say that I flushed it because it was not the way. That would imply that I had some level of self-awareness. Uh-huh. At that point, which I did. I flushed it because I was just paranoid and I just...
The only
way to get over this awful feeling was to watch it go down the toilet.
Interesting.
So yeah, I can't say
that. You weren't up to the point yet that it was like, this is bad for me and I can't do that.
No. Right. But this was, and it was my 20th year as a practicing lawyer too. And of course I knew it was wrong.
Right.
I've done cocaine in state and federal courthouses and all kinds of different places where the consequences were severe. If I was caught, of course I knew it was wrong. What's the definition of addiction? Obsessive compulsive drug-seeking behavior in the face of known consequences, right?
Did you ever meet up with those consequences in a severe fashion?
I was arrested for DWI, but I beat the consequences because I pled not guilty as was my right to make the state prove their case. And this is a whole nother story. The state trooper who arrested me retired and moved back to wherever in Texas that was not in Dallas. And he decided he wasn't coming back to testify against Brian Cuban.
Wow.
He was off enjoying his retirement, so they had to drop the case.
So you had some sort of special fairy that was allowing you to dodge these.
Well, yes. I mean, but there were, of course, there were consequences. I have three failed marriages, all failing around
your addiction.
Hiding my addiction, my drug use, and specifically my cocaine use, although I had a drinking issue as well. And so, yeah, there are consequences. It was a strain on my family. It caused family rifts. There are always consequences. They just fall at different levels. And it's, how we adjust to them instead of face them.
So what, everybody has like sort of a different story about it, like how their addiction developed, what happened. It seems like you came from you had a nice nuclear family. You had, you're close to your brothers, your parents. What was it for you that sort of pointed you in that direction? Or was it just something that, you were genetically predisposed to need?
No, I would argue for me, it was trauma-based, a strong correlation of trauma. There is no genetic predisposition in my family that I am aware of.
Right.
No one in my nuclear family, no one else has ever struggled with alcohol or drug use. There was a lot of fat shaming in my house, and I had a very difficult relationship with my mother, and I don't blame. And again, there's a difference between cause and correlation. My mother did not cause any of this, and I don't blame her for any of it. But things that happen in the household can correlate, right, with mental health issues later in life. Correlation means it will happen to some people, it won't happen to others.
Right.
My mom was had a very verbally and mentally abusive relationship with her mother. She was fat shamed, and there were a lot of different going things. And this was the 70s. It kind of ran downhill, and I was an obese kid.
Because you look great now. You might.
I still struggle with body image issues, but I was a obese kid. I was fat shamed by my mom as she was fat shamed by her mom. And I was physically assaulted and had my pants torn off me by some school classmates.
Bullying episodes.
Yeah, I was pantsed. And because they thought my shiny gold bell-bottom disco pants that my brother Mark had given me were too tight on me. And they tore them off, ripped them into shreds, threw them in the street. Very traumatic. And so these were the kind of things that formed my self-image as a child. And formed a nucleus of self-hatred. I began to see somebody who was just not worthy of love every time I looked in the mirror, though my mother loved me dearly.
Right.
Just not worthy of love, who would never get married, who would never have his first date, his first kiss, all these different things. And this was the image that I dragged. This was the Brian that I dragged through life as my baggage. And so I began trying to love that Brian through different things. And again, this was starting at 18 years old. I began binging and purging, eating disorder. And then by the time I went into my early 20s, I was a full-blown at college, quote-unquote, alcoholic, alcohol use disorder. I put it in air quotes because alcoholic is a label, not a diagnosis.
Okay.
And then by my mid-20s, I was...
Would you care to expand on what you mean when you say that alcoholic is a label, not a diagnosis?
Sure. Alcoholic is it has its own etymology, words, not etymology, as
etymology,
bugs,
right.
It is a label popularized by 12 step, which is fine. I got sober in 12 step that, someone says, okay, I'm an alcoholic, so I need help.
Okay.
It is a very helpful label, right?
Right.
But it is not a medical diagnosis, a DSM-5 diagnosis, which is alcohol use disorder, which is the diagnosis we need to get treatment. The diagnosis when you go into residential treatment is an alcoholic.
Right.
Alcohol use disorder. And alcohol use disorder is can be diagnosed through several different tools, such as the audit, AUDIT. A tool. So it's a very important distinction. Alcoholic is a self-label we give ourselves, but it's an important label because it's the label that many people come to terms with their problems with.
Interesting. So it's more of, is it more of a medical thing or it's more of a perception thing? Like when you push back on the idea of an alcoholic, you know, being a diagnosis.
I'm not pushing back. I'm not pushing back against it. When I walked into the rooms of 12-step, that was the label I gave myself.
Right.
But it's not a label that I feel that has to define me. Right. I don't, whether I am a quote unquote alcoholic, mm-hmm. Or not, to me is irrelevant.
Right.
It's how I live my life. Am I hitting the pillars of recovery, my family life, my relationships, my work life, my goals? That's what's important to
right.
me.
I mean, do you think that, like, for some people, like, you know, for you, who, you know, you clearly have accepted that helped you, even you're saying that it even helped you, that you identified as somebody that has, that's an alcoholic, and therefore you're gonna, you know, try to make changes. I'm just wondering if some people it would be, you know, an adverse reaction, like, oh, you're calling me an alcoholic, and
it causes a lot of tension between the two schools of recovery. I mean, there are people who believe abstinence is the only way. They're 12-step, boom, boom, and this is how they stay sober. And that's great. I mean, but it gets into these things, especially in social media, where I've voiced my viewpoints and someone says, well, you're not a real alcoholic then. And I think to myself, isn't that the goal? Right? Isn't yeah. that what I want? To not be an alcoholic anymore? So I try not to get into those kind of tension battles, but right. I don't label myself as an alcoholic. To me, it's an irrelevant label. To someone else, it may be a very important label.
Interesting.
I'm a part. If you take a drink, you know, what would you take a drink if you're not an alcoholic? No, but it's not because I'm an alcoholic. It's, well, why would I? I've seen the damage
that it does to you.
I've right. lived the damage it does to me. Why would I want to experiment with that again? And that doesn't mean I'm afraid that I will go back to that. I see no upside to taking a drink.
Got it.
Now differently in terms of, I look at cocaine a little differently. I absolutely am in fear of, I wouldn't say in fear, because I don't fear cocaine. I don't hang in those circles anymore. But I would absolutely be concerned that I would develop a dependence and go back to trying to, feel a certain way.
So it's interesting. So you're saying that for you, the feeling of cocaine was something that actually, like, you still identify with that feeling, like, oh, that feeling would still be awesome, as opposed to alcohol, where you're saying that you don't even see the upside of taking a drink anymore.
That's right. That's right. I would be much more concerned about doing a line of cocaine than taking a drink.
Because of how it made you feel?
Because of how it made me feel.
Interesting. So I would expand. This is interesting to me. So, like, alcohol is something that, like, is sort of something that, like, numbed the pain or made you forget about your stuff, and cocaine gave you an actual, like, positive, awesome feeling. And is that what it is?
Alcohol allowed me to numb my pain. And I would mix it with, and this is awful, but I'm lucky to be alive, I would mix it with Xanax, and it would be part of my routine with cocaine. But before I became dependent and then addicted to cocaine, all I was I was a quote-unquote alcoholic.
Right.
Alcohol use disorder in college, for sure. And I carried that through law school because I was deadening the pain. I didn't want to feel. But cocaine was different, and cocaine allowed me to feel, even though it was artificial.
It allowed you to feel a different feeling instead of just forgetting about the feeling that you wanted to run away from.
That's right. I don't want to not feel. I want to feel.
Right. And that's why cocaine is a bigger fear. That's very interesting. So you go to college. You become a lawyer. Like, how was that? Getting through college, actually doing the work. You were skating by. Did you show up to class? How'd you get, you know, grades? Like,
well,
how did
college,
you?
Colleges was a little easier to skate by. I was a criminal justice major. I wanted to be a police officer. That would have worked out well. I'd have been the first guy in the evidence rooms trading out the cocaine for the mannitol, stealing the cocaine.
Yeah,
but
that career would have lasted really long.
Yeah. College. I mean, college. It was not a pleasant experience for me. I was getting drunk every night. I was also binging and purging. I had also developed exercise bulimia, which is obsessive compulsive exercise for the primary purpose of offsetting calories. So I was going on these long runs. I was binging and purging. I was drinking alone at Penn State. And but exams are graded on a professors weren't, and this is back in the 80s, professors weren't anal about attendance, and I was able to pull it together and pull all-nighters and then give back the information the next day and get pretty decent grades. And so I remember sitting in the placement office, thumbing through police officer jobs, and there were a couple of guys next to me from Pittsburgh, where I'm from, okay, talking about going to law school and going to Pitt Law. And I'm listening to them, and the bells start going off in my head. Not the bells of I wanted to be a lawyer. I had never thought about being a lawyer. I didn't know any lawyers. I had no concept of what it meant to be a lawyer. The bells of, Ryan, you can stay in law school is 3 years. So you can stay in school three more years and you can drink, you can binge and purge, and you can run, and you can engage in the same survival behaviors, because that's what it was for me.
Right.
Just the behaviors that allowed me to survive moment to moment, day to day, and not have to reveal yourself to the world, just like you did at Penn State.
So it was more an excuse to stay in school and not embrace yet the life of responsibility that was coming next.
It was an excuse to not embrace the life of having to face my problems.
Right.
Rather than to, so it, not having to survive on life's terms instead of using these different destructive coping behaviors. And so that made perfect sense. That made perfect sense for me to go to law school. That's why I went. No other reason.
So you never really loved being a lawyer, not one day.
Nope, not one day. Not one day. Hated it every day. I never wanted to be a lawyer. There were times you litigate and you do this, or were there moments, of course, but there was always the underlying self-hatred. And so I decided to go to Pitt Law for that reason. Now, the difference is that I could skate at Penn State, but you can't get through law school and do well like that, right? Yeah, you're competing with everyone else. Exams aren't graded on a curve. exams aren't straight percentage. You're graded competing against other students.
Right.
And it was difficult, and I graduated near the bottom of my class. I was going to class drunk. I was not showing up for class. I was drinking alone, repeating the exact same coping mechanisms that I engaged in at Penn State. And it was pretty close. I still have reoccurring dreams of going to get my diploma and the dean of the law school pulling it back, going, psych, you didn't graduate. And I wake up kind of sweating, grabbing for this imaginary diploma. The irony of that was that I was so ashamed of myself, so self-hating, that I didn't even bother going to graduation. I didn't care. Just mail it to me. And the complete circle of all that was,
there wasn't even like a place where like you could like tell your family, like, look, I graduated, come to my graduation, I'm a lawyer now. There wasn't even that. Even that wasn't going to give you a sense of pride.
I don't even remember talking to my family about law school. There's a whole thing about Hayes. I don't know how much my family knew about my law school experience. My father's deceased now, so I can't ask him. And I certainly wasn't having conversations with my mother about it. So I think it was more one day me just mentioning to them that I'm in law school.
And then like, hey, I graduated.
And I graduated. And the irony, the full circle of all that is that a few weeks ago, I was invited to keynote at my law school's graduation.
There you go. Now you get to go to graduation.
And I wore a cap and gown for the 2021 University of Pittsburgh School of Law graduation. I wore a cap and gown. And it was full circle, and it was wonderful.
That's amazing. Your life of recovery and post-law sort of brought you back to your law school graduation.
It did. And I had I started and funded one of the first alumni-created student wellness funds in the country for law schools.
Wow. And is that something that's specific to Pitt Law, or is that something
Pitt Law.
Very cool. Wow. So you become a lawyer and you move to Dallas. How did you end up in Dallas? Was your family had already moved to Dallas? Because you said you were from Pittsburgh.
both of my brothers had moved to Dallas, so they both already lived here, Mark and Jeff. And for me, it was a logical move because I wanted to get out of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania, where my experiences were only bullying and miserable.
Right.
My relationships with my mom at that point was still not good. We have a wonderful relationship today. And then, so I decided to move there. And it was, with, I think, $100 to my name, I took a Greyhound bus and Mark met me at the bus station and I moved in with my brother Mark. And it was like throwing gasoline on a fire because they were young. This is the mid-80s in Dallas. They're dating. They're going to the bars.
Everybody was still single then.
Everyone was single and out having a good time. Right. And so I fit right in and my drinking escalated. And then in the summer of 87, that next summer, I discovered the one thing in a bathroom in a upscale bar in Dallas, Texas, befitting my non-barred status, wearing my suit that I had from high school, pretending I was a lawyer.
So you had never passed the bar?
I hadn't taken the bar yet, but I failed the bar three times, all as a result of my drug and alcohol issues. They were more important than studying. And I discovered cocaine.
So cocaine came post-college?
Yes,
cocaine came during your formative years. You were drinking
alcohol. College was only alcohol. Penn State was only alcohol.
Interesting. So you discover cocaine in an airport bathroom?
No, in a hotel bathroom. Hotel bathroom in downtown Dallas.
What happened? You walked in and there was cocaine sitting on the sink.
No, it was I was at a bar with a buddy of mine, who has also found recovery and put all that behind him, and he introduced me to his dealer and. I was scared. He said, you need to try this. You'll feel great. And so the dealer gave me some lines gratis. And I remember the first feeling.
You got like a sampler.
Gave me a sampler. And it was running down. And the trigger warning to anyone who's in recovery, move away if you don't want to hear this because I'm going to give some description.
Okay.
It was running down the back of my throat. You know, it runs down and my entire throat went numb. And I thought I was going to die because I couldn't swallow. And then, but then came the other feeling where it just swooped up, looked in the mirror and say, wow, that guy's handsome.
Wow.
All the girls love that guy. The girls who rejected me from the prom for the prom love that guy. The girls upstairs that I'm going to go hit on now because I am no longer brutally shy love that guy.
They already love me now. They haven't even met me yet.
Yeah, everyone in Dallas, my mother loves that guy. You know, all these things. And she did love that guy, really. But and I had never felt that before. And it was Katie bar the door because I had to have that feeling.
Again and again and again.
And alcohol and cocaine took over my life.
Now, did it ever stop for you? Like, did it come to a point where it wasn't giving you that feeling, but you just needed it like physically or?
Sure. And I think, I don't know. You go through those thought processes. I mean, it got really bad for me, the whole cycle, because I added Xanax to it. So basically, as a lawyer, it got to the point, and this is moving up through the summer of 2005, after I have two failed marriages up to that, before that point, where I was cycling through days, cocaine at night and alcohol at night, then Xanax and alcohol in the morning, and sleep through the day, cocaine at night. And I was showing up at court intoxicated and hungover. How I wasn't disbarred or grievance filed against me is amazing. It is truly amazing that I skated through all that.
And you actually survived and you're living to tell the story.
A lot of lawyers don't. Yeah, the Xanax and the cocaine, people die. Right. Like the Xanax withdrawal and the sleeping pills. So I was going through all of this and getting it all on the black market. But
where was the money coming from?
I had good years as a lawyer. I had some pretty good years as a lawyer. And so despite myself.
Right.
And so that eventually dried up. But in the summer of 2005, there was nothing that was quelling the pain. There was nothing that was changing how I felt about myself. And I decided to end my life by suicide. So believe me. Cocaine wasn't the end all to the high life.
So there were 17 years. Basically, you're doing cocaine from 1987 till 2005. 2005, it comes to sort of a head. Like, cocaine's not giving you what you need anymore. So now you have no escape. Is that what it was?
It wasn't that thought process. 2005 came to a head because I couldn't stop the pain, and I didn't see any point. The only way in my mind I could stop the pain was to end my life by suicide. It wasn't a specific thought process about cocaine. It was a specific process about my life is worthless. It will always be worthless. I would be doing my family a favor. That was the thought process.
Wow. And it's so ironic because you talk about it in your book a little bit, you know, and you read about people that have survived, you know, suicide, etc. And always that's a common theme that, you know, I'm a burden to other people. I'm not giving anything to anyone. They don't need me. My life is just making other people problems. And so often the people that survive it will come back to tell you that the reaction of the people that love them and, you know, those people are like, we need you. And it's sort of like it almost invokes that, like, you got to know that we need you. And it will be tremendously painful if this would have actually, you know, come to fruition.
I had a weapon and I sent some disturbing emails to a friend who I dedicated my very first book to for saving my life. He got a hold of my two brothers. And my first brother, my younger brother, Jeff, came into the house. And I was upstairs, I mean, the Xanax and a Coke, and I'm lying in bed just, and the 45 automatic is on my nightstand.
Wow.
And so he confiscated the weapon. My brother Mark flew in from LA, and they cleaned up, and they took me in my first of two trips down to a Dallas psychiatric hospital, kicking and screaming. They're trying to save my life, and all I can think of is get out of my life and let me finish what I wanted to do.
Right.
And so they took me down there, and as a lawyer, they were trying to put a psychiatric hold on me. And in Texas, you have to be a danger to yourself and others. So as a lawyer, I knew what to say, so they couldn't do that, much to their chagrin.
Right.
Here's where privilege comes in. I would be disingenuous to not acknowledge the privilege that I have gone through in both addiction, active addiction, and recovery. They say there's a saying that recovery addiction doesn't discriminate. Well, it really does, okay? Because addiction hits different demographics differently, right?
Right.
And recovery does absolutely discriminate can discriminate based on privilege and access to resources.
Right.
I had access to money and resources out the yazoo. Very few people have billionaire brothers.
Right. Was that difficult for you in a way, though? Was it, you know, sort of being in that shadow or it didn't?
That's a different conversation we can talk about.
Okay.
But I'll get through the story. So okay. They're ready to make their, I could have flown directly from treatment to Florida. That
right.
They were ready to do that. I refused. I wasn't ready for recovery. I just wanted them out of my life so I could go back to now the people who really love me, the people who didn't judge me. At least until the cocaine ran out. So they drove me back home, and we did what I call the Cuban rehab. They took my car keys, said, "Stay in the house for 2 weeks, and everything's going to be okay. Everything will be okay." They didn't know.
Right.
My family's no different. I had a few thoughts to that. One, fine, my drug dealer delivers. No problem there. Two, now they know. Now they really know.
Right.
And what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to distance. So after that, I stopped communicating with them, my family, my father, all the people who love me, and began to really withdraw into my own world. And I called a cab. They weren't going to tell me what to do. I called a cab to went to the car dealership and got another set of keys made. They weren't telling me what to do.
Wow.
I mean, this isn't unusual with people dealing with these issues, right? No one's going to tell us what to do,
right? But it's interesting. So was this was sort of the first realization for your family about like how deeply rooted your problems were at that point?
I think they suspected that this was the first time it was in their face.
Right. They couldn't sort of brush it away anymore.
That I was in crisis.
Right.
I was in crisis. After that, I did bring the party to me, and I was right back out. And so, and then another failed marriage. And at this point, I had no job. Now my career had imploded. My career had imploded. I had no clients left. It gets around when you're showing up, when you're not serving your clients and you're showing up to the courthouse looking like a mess and this and that. It gets around, right?
Right.
And the clients stopped coming in. And this is where privilege comes in again. My brother Mark put me to work for him. I failed miserably, showing up at meetings drunk and hungover and all those things.
You were working for the Mavs at the time?
Working for him personally.
Personally.
I've never worked for the Mavs directly.
Got it.
So working for him personally as his kind of jack of all trades lawyer. He was trying to give me an opportunity to pull myself up.
Together,
that's
right.
Not how addiction works either.
Right.
And so he was really just giving me a paycheck and I was doing nothing. Is that enabling? Well, enabling is a tough thing to judge in the moment, right? He saved my life.
Right.
Because I could have been living under a bridge. I might have tried again to end my life by suicide. It's the enabling that got me on the show talking to you over 14 years in recovery.
It's such a fine line. When we talk to people, the struggle of the support people, the people that are supporting you, the struggle of giving them what they need, keeping them alive, and not, like you say, enabling them to continue doing what they're doing. It's just like, it's so hard to define it. You know what I mean? I think it sort of varies from person to person as well.
It's for every, there's that gray area between love, enablement, and recovery is one of the most brutal parts of the family dynamic.
Right.
And for me, the privilege I lived in, financial privilege, skin color privilege, all of these different privileges came together that I had the benefit of a brother and family who loved me dearly, another privilege, because many do not have that.
Right.
That also came with very deep pockets. I've seen families bankrupted trying to figure out that gray area between love, enablement, and recovery. My family wasn't going to be bankrupted. And so right. It would be so intellectually dishonest of me not to acknowledge that I am a little bit outside the Venn diagram, right?
Right, right.
With that. Or way outside the Venn diagram with that issue.
In your book, you have some diary entries and you talk about the first time you walked into AA. And I think that was the day of your sober date, right? April 11, 2007. This is what Brian writes in his book.
Well, actually, those are missed diaries. My sober date is April 8th, 2007.
April 8th. Got it.
I was not in an accurate dating sort of mind back then.
Gotcha. So that's in the book it says April 11, but you're saying that
I started keeping the diary April 11th.
Got it. So I just want to read this because it moved me. It was so hard for me to walk through the doors of AA. Pride, shame, still detoxing, fear, abandonment, feeling them all at once. I dreamed last night that the city of Boston was burning, and I walked through it. I realized today that in almost every single stupid decision I've made, alcohol's played a factor. That's a diary entry from April 11th, 2007, 3 days after your sober date.
I can tell you what the context of that dream was. My girlfriend at the time, who had just moved in with me, and now my wife, our relationship did survive it.
Wow.
All this, and we've been together over 15 years. But at that time, we'd barely been dating a year. And so she had moved in with me, and she had recently moved back to Texas from Boston, where she was a lawyer. And so that was, and she moved out.
So your wife is a lawyer as well?
Yeah, she's a legal recruiter. But at that time, she was a practicing lawyer.
Got it.
And she had moved in with me, and this all happened, and she moved out. And I was terrified she was going to leave me. That was the context of that dream.
Got it. Wow. But what struck me in this diary entry was all these different feelings. Like, at the same time that you're proud that you're actually going to AA and you're trying to change your life and maybe it's going to stick and you're hoping it's going to stick, there's still that shame, there's still the fear, there's still the abandonment, everything's sort of like mixed up, and like you're making this move and like, you know, it's just a lot. It's like sort of an overwhelming feeling.
Sure.
And you got through it and sort of.
Sure. And here's what, sitting in that, when I walked in April 8th, and it was kind of funny, before I'd gone to my first meeting, I got a little more honest with my psychiatrist, and he's the one who, he said, you can go to it. Back then, you didn't have all these other options, right? The harm reduction or whatever.
Right.
Not that harm reduction would have worked for me. I had to, abstinence is the only path would have worked for me. There's no such thing as one line of cocaine for me and one drink. So, but.
But you believe that that varies from person to person. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. The path to recovery are many. And that's another area where I knock heads with the abstinence only crowd, especially within advocacy, within the rooms, Great. I get it, but I don't judge anyone's path to recovery. You know, here's an example. This drives people crazy when I say this. I took the Texas recovery coach certification.
Okay.
All that. And I went through the course and I passed the test. And if someone came to me, I don't practice. I just used it to enhance my knowledge. I don't charge people to come to me or anything like that. But if someone came to me and said, Brian, I'm doing an 8-ball of cocaine, 3.5 grams.
Right.
A week. But if I could get down to my life is a mess. If I can get down to a gram a week and things will be great. I'm not going to say to that person, no, you have to stop or you'll die. I'm going to say, why do you think that'll be better? And okay, let's set goals and let's try that. And then you tell me if it's better. That's harm reduction. If somebody's you're drinking a bottle of gin a week and they tell me they think they can get down to a glass, or whatever, I'm not going to say, no, you have to stop or you're going to die. I'm going to listen and help them achieve their goals. And then you say, how's that working for you?
Got it. But there is when you're dealing with such dangerous substances, like, that carry such fatality risks, like cocaine and heroin and these types of things, isn't there a danger that if you don't abstain, then you might lose your life?
Let's not buy into to false narratives. The overwhelming fatal OD risk with heroin is contaminated heroin, right? Mm-hmm. You have to separate with fentanyl. The right. OD crisis related to heroin is fentanyl related,
right?
Not necessarily just standalone right. heroin related.
But it is very difficult nowadays to know when it's
Absolutely. The issue is everything informed? Right. Our decisions informed.
Right.
And would I say if someone asked me if I think that's the best path, I'd say for me, no. Right. Right. And here are the risks. I mean, you can any given line, you can die. Any given pill, you can die. It can be contaminated. So people have to understand those risks.
Right.
But harm reduction, whether it's through Suboxone or methadone, to get people back, to get people into a lifestyle where they can live,
right.
is a valid strategy. Is it a strategy that would have worked for me? Probably not. But I don't judge other people's recovery pathways, and it just cringes me when I see these abstinence hawk who just say it's replacing one addiction for another. It is not. It is not. And it just gets me on a soapbox and makes me sad.
You're on the soapbox.
Because that's how people die when you shame people out of recovery pathways. That's how they die. Because when we shame people, people are going to use regardless. And they're going to find the drugs. And when you shame people onto the streets of Kensington, and wherever in Philadelphia and onto the streets, that's where the risk is, right? When you're forcing them out there to do that, because there's no way to know what you're getting.
There has to be a way to find each person's individual path to recovery.
That's right. That's right. And if it's, I'm all for abstinence.
Abstinence worked for you. Abstinence worked for you.
I'm all for abstinence. Yay, abstinence. It worked for me. Yay, Suboxone. If that's allowing you to hit all the pillars of recovery with wife, children, work, all your goals. Yay, methadone, if it's allowing you to do this. Now, we can get into should all of that, because I see this too. Well, the path, that's great, but the path should always be abstinence, right? So we have you're on methadone, you're on Suboxone, you're doing this, you're on Vivitrol, whatever it is.
But the goal, you mean the goal, the end goal.
The end game should always be abstinence. So we have that in the middle. And that's not my judgment to make. I can tell you that abstinence is great for me.
Right. It's really worked
for you. I will never force my recovery path down anyone's throat.
You found a writing career. You were a lawyer. You found a writing career. Do you think that finding something that you love helped you stay on the path?
Absolutely. So you're in 12-step, right? You're going through. I did my 100 meetings in 90 days and all right. that. So I had to find things that gave me joy and gave me purpose, sense of purpose in life, other than cocaine, to fill those gaps. So that took time, right? You search and you search. And during the searching period, I relied a lot on my compassionate community to fight through those brutal, brutal times in that brutal, brutal pull. I need to get back out there with these people, my peeps, my cocaine right. peeps. Got to get back out there because I'm lonely, I'm bored, I'm unloved. I'm ashamed. They will unbore me. I will no longer be lonely. They will love me. All of this pull right back out to that lifestyle. And that was the hardest part for me. That was absolutely the hardest part. And so I relied on my 12-step community. I relied on my family. I relied on the community, compassionate community I created outside of 12-step. And I relied on the activities and behaviors that I created that gave me a sense of joy, a sense of purpose in life. And writing was one of them. Writing continues to be one of them.
And was that something that you had always enjoyed, or it's something that you found?
I always had a creative side. I just wasn't able to find it without sobriety.
Right. So it's sort of like a self-fulfilling, it's a good cycle, meaning you abstain, then you look for something to give you meaning, and that allows you to continue to stay in recovery.
Yeah, how am I going to find those things when I'm zonked out, Xanaxed out in bed every day and cocaine my way through the night, right? I mean, how am I going to find my passions?
Right.
It's impossible. I mean, it got so bad for me. I don't know if I talked about this in the book, and I think about this a lot of just what my, as a microcosm of my life, I was Xanaxing cocaine. And at a time I was also I was unable to exercise and get into my exercise routine because I was always going, in this cycle. So I decided to try this weight loss drug. I forget what it's called, but it's one of those things that blocks some beta blockers. And it can cause some different side effects. And I took it. I took Xanax and I ended up shitting in my pants. There it is, right? I was drunk. I was Xanaxed out. Bloop. There's the life.
That's what it boils down to. We were talking a little bit before about your family. Your family was like a huge, I see it in the book. It's a huge element of how you're here today. It's like, support from friends, from family. This is what we hear from people that made it back, like you were talking about, like the privilege of having that support system. You're the middle brother. You're the middle brother, right?
I'm the middle.
You're the middle brother. Was it a struggle for you that your brothers were successful? We touched on this. Was that like a kind of weird place to be?
This is a question I get asked quite a bit. You have to remember that I was struggling with alcohol. I was struggling with cocaine and I had an eating disorder. And I hated myself long before Mark became famous, actually famous. So no, his fame didn't cause any of that.
Right.
Right. None of this is Mark.
Yeah. I wasn't sort of talking about the fame aspect, more like the success, right? Because obviously it wasn't overnight. Mark obviously was a guy.
Well,
fame,
success. I mean, yeah. Right. So what happened is that I never had my own sense of self-identity, right? I hated myself. Every time I looked in the mirror, that consumed who I was. And so when Mark became internationally famous and successful, all of a sudden, I could walk into any bar I wanted without waiting in line. People were shoving cocaine in my pocket. I was dating girls half my age. All of a sudden, everyone loved Brian.
All the doors open.
All the doors open, and it had nothing to do with my accomplishments, right? I call it name fame. It had nothing to do with my accomplishments, but because I had my no self-identity whatsoever, I thought to myself, okay, I'll embrace that.
This is cool. This works.
Just like cocaine gave me the artificial self-love, I can embrace all these things to feel good about myself.
And, another survival tactic.
Yeah, and become Mark Cuban's brother.
Right.
And that was fine with me because all of that seemed great at the time, right?
Right.
That's what happened. None of that is Mark's fault.
Right. And ultimately, the way that you've succeeded is by carving out your own self-identity, by writing, by inspiring people. It's amazing, you know, what you've done with your life and how you've come back with all the privileges, you know, acknowledged, but there's a lot of hard work here too. You know, I know you're chalking it up all to privilege, but I see
I'm not chalking it up all to privilege, but it's disingenuous.
I understand.
To discount my last name.
Got it.
In opening doors.
But I do want to make sure that you give yourself a little credit too, or that I give you credit.
Self-deprecation is one of the problems I still struggle with.
Very cool. What was your experience with talking to lawyers for this book? Like, why do you think it is so such a problem in the legal profession? And what was your impressions of talking to all the people that you talked to? You know, the different profiles that you have through your book. Like, what stuck out to you in terms of cocaine and boozing in the legal profession?
That we're all people, all lawyers. I mean, everyone. What struck me is that not necessarily the legal profession. Let's start out with the legal profession has a very high rate of alcohol use disorder, alcoholism. Over 20% of all licensed attorneys would qualify as having alcohol use disorder, alcoholics, under the audit and some other tools, diagnostic tools, which is almost twice the U.S. rate. So that's a problem. About a third suffer from diagnosable depression. We have the fourth highest white collar suicide rate, and so it's a. What struck me in talking to all the different people is that it's rarely just I'm a lawyer, so here's the problem. Stress. It is like me. We are all an accumulation of snapshots throughout our life, trauma, family problems, different things that create who we are, right? And so, and that's no, we're all humans that way. That's no different than taxi drivers, grill cooks. We are all an accumulation of snapshots. Now, does the legal profession attract people who may be predisposed, not genetically, but the type A personalities and things like that? Sure. Sure, that can be an issue. The lawyers tend to be closed off to allowing ourselves to show vulnerability. That's an issue. So we tend to internalize our struggles because we are taught to take advantage of vulnerability, not to show it. So those are issues. So there are a wide swath.
It's an aggregate. Brian, you have a book coming out. Your first foray into fiction. What's that book going to be called?
Do
we have a title?
Huh? It's called The Ambulance Chaser.
The Ambulance Chaser. Look out for The Ambulance Chaser. It's hitting the stands in December of 2021, tentatively.
It's about a Pittsburgh lawyer who is a personal injury lawyer who is accused of the murder of a high school classmate 30 years prior. Her remains are discovered, and he has to go on the run to find to both find the one person who can prove his innocence and save the life of his only son.
So it's a legal thriller.
Yes.
Watch out, Grisham. Brian Cuban's coming for you. Brian, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your experiences, your insight, your story of adversity, and ultimately triumph. It's an inspiration. Check out Brian's forthcoming book, as we just said, The Ambulance Chaser. Follow him on Twitter at @bcuban. For speaking engagements, Brian at addictedlawyer.com. All these are ways that you can reach out to Brian. Brian, thank you so much for coming on. Best of luck to you in the future. Thank you so much for just sharing your story. Is there any last thoughts you want to share?
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, don't forget I have a current book out, The Addicted Lawyer. And wherever you stand, we all have compassionate community, right? You just may not realize it at the time. And then sometimes it's hard to reach out. And if you are part of that compassionate community, don't sit on your heels. Here's what I'll leave you with, the two-ask rule. If you think someone's struggling, You don't have to, without being accusatory or judgmental, they're having a tough day. Just ask how they're doing and have that conversation. And before that conversation breaks, ask if they know that they can reach out to you if they want to. With those few seconds, with those two questions, you've become a link and a cog of mental health where that person may at some point, if we all just ask those two questions, it may not be with you, but it's an accumulation. And they may be down the road and finally say, yes, I'm ready.
That's amazing. One more quick drive-by question on the way out. Does Luka have a chance? Does Luka have a chance to be better than Dirk?
Don't put me in that spot. Luka's Luka. Dirk were Dirk. Dirk was Dirk. They are both. Dirk is an icon. Luka will be an icon.
That's a wrap on another edition of Rubber Bands. Thank you, Brian Cuban, for coming on, sharing your story. Please rate, listen, subscribe. Rubber Bands, conversations about the push and pull of addiction, a podcast for the addiction community. Thank you, guys. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.